From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. Throughout two global finance crises, it was the Chinese economy that kept the world. So, as China slows, there is considerable concern about just how far the downturn could go. The former treasurer and economist Stephen Joshi is now the Beijing-based Asia manager for Australia Supper. He told China correspondent Stephen McDonald that while the Asian giant has its problems, it's certainly not going into a free fall.
The weak manufacturing data we got out last Friday largely reflects weakness in the export sector. Global trade has actually been stagnant for the past 3 years, which is quite unusual, and things may be getting a little bit worse, and that's showing up in this manufacturing survey. And beyond that, there's some other things worrying in the Chinese economy. You know, the housing construction is at a low point, a cyclical low point, and that has much broader effects on heavy industry in China, particularly the steel industry. And we see that in Australia because it flows straight through to the iron ore price.
You know, the Chinese economy is a big and complicated thing, but as best you can, if you were to list what's going right and what's going wrong at the moment, what would it be?
The things that are wrong, I guess, are a housing downturn, a slump in heavy industry and very weak export markets. The things that are going right are actually quite significant because on the private consumption side, we're seeing retail sales really powering along and holding up the Chinese economy, growing it around in double digits. The housing cycle, while it's quite low at the moment, actual housing construction is low. We're seeing signs that the cycle's bottomed and is picking up. And the main leading indicator here is housing prices. We've seen some good, strong growth in the last few months in housing prices, particularly in the coastal cities. But probably most significant positive news is actually that credit growth in China has picked up in the last couple of months. And with a lag of a few months, that should help to support the economy.
You mentioned that it's not so clear whether or not a pickup in housing prices will mean more housing construction in the inland of China. But even if it didn't, just say it was just in the wealthier parts of China, could that have a significant impact on, well, steel production, for example, or the need for Australian iron ore?
It'll help, but it wouldn't get our hopes up too high in the sense that most of the construction activity does occur outside the coastal cities now.
In Australia, there's a lot of interest regarding Chinese steel production. What is the situation at the moment?
Yeah, the steel industry is very weak at the moment. It reflects the housing cycle. I guess the significant thing is this isn't some collapse or some free fall in Chinese steel industry. It's just a normal housing cycle. Probably one of the key things is we don't expect a really strong upside to this housing cycle. So it's stabilised, but the upside's probably less than in the past.
Well, Australian steel producers are complaining that China's producing too much of their own, flooding the market. How can that be if you're saying the steel industry is in trouble here?
Essentially what happens when the steel demand in China slows down, Chinese steel producers try and export their surplus production onto global markets. This has happened a number of times in the past and they're doing it again. Probably the key question actually is what's the stockpile of unsold homes in inland China? Some of the data suggests it's still quite high, which suggests low demand for steel, but the data's not entirely accurate, so we're really going to have to wait and see whether this strong rise in housing prices on coastal China actually moves inland or not.
And what about the stock market here? To what extent should we view what happens on the Chinese stock market and the health of the Chinese economy?
The Chinese stock market isn't really closely related to the economy. You know, the Chinese stock market soared since September last year and has lost about a third of its gains. But this sort of volatility isn't unusual for emerging market stock market that still really has growing pains. This massive surge in the stock market didn't have a big effect on people's actual spending, so we're not expecting a dramatic downside from the correction either.
That was economist Stephen Joshi speaking to our Beijing correspondent Stephen McDonald. Global stocks staged a major rebound after China's central bank cut interest rates to defend its crashing share market. Wall Street closed more than 1% weaker as of the recording of this program, and investors jumped on beaten down companies. Now, despite China's emergency stimulus, concerns remain that a faster-than-expected slowdown in the Chinese economy could have a fallout around the world. We have this story from our North America correspondent, Michael Vincent.
No sooner had the street sweepers made their way past the big bronze bull statue and down to Wall Street than the traders were finishing their coffees and heading to their desks. Buoyed by the opening in Europe, there was a strong dose of optimism about US stocks.
I'm feeling pretty good. They'll come back up.
They always do?
They always do.
You're an optimist today. You gonna be a buyer?
Yeah, actually, I probably am. I mean, I think China was inflated and we needed a correction, and people should have known this was coming.
Some New Yorkers passing by were still rocked by the newspaper's front pages, like the Post's big grizzly picture and headline, Wild Bears Maul Marts in Dizzy Dow Spiral.
I feel scared, very scared. It's people's life savings, and we don't know what's going to happen, but hopefully we'll pull through for the long haul, but it's scary, very scary.
But by and large, there was a good sense that yesterday's losses would be reversed. Fewer were happier to be heading into the New York Stock Exchange than Stephen Joyce.
I feel really good. We're in the hotel business. We're here to ring the bell. We're with Choice Hotels, and we're excited about where the market's headed today because we think we're going to help start a rise in the not only in the stock market, but also the U.S. economy, which is doing really well.
Soon after, the CEO rang the opening bell. Immediately, the Dow and the S&P 500 shot up, steadying at 2% higher. The Nasdaq went over 3%, its best one-day gain since 2011. Hank Smith from Haverford Trust says the correction has meant buying opportunities.
I think the bull market is still intact, and I think you buy on these dips. If you have cash on the sidelines, you commit that cash on the dips. You're never going to get the absolute bottom correctly. Would you rather own a 10-year at 2% or the plethora of 3 and 4% blue chips that are offered today?
The Nasdaq is still on track, though, for its worst month since November 2008. And the Dow is also on track for its worst month since 2009. But Hank Smith says that's nothing to fear.
I think we have a little bit more volatility to go. I wouldn't be surprised if this bounces around. But we do firmly believe that this is just a correction. It is nothing more. It's not the beginning of a bear market. Bear markets occur in anticipations of a recession. And there are no signs of a recession in the U.S. going out 12 to 18 months.
That prediction that a U.S. recession is still some time off has been helped again by fresh housing figures showing new home sales were higher than 5% in July. This is Michael Vincent at the New York Stock Exchange.
It's been just over a week since a bombing of a popular tourist attraction in central Bangkok took place, and police still appear to have no idea who carried the atrocity out or why. 20 people died in the explosion and 125 were injured. Because of the location and timing, it's created grave fears that the Thai Tourism Board could be its target. And since it happened, a number of strange and misleading statements by the military junta have fueled questions about competency of the investigation. Peter Lloyd reports.
For a hardline dictator who shows no real willingness to relinquish power, the soldier running Thailand sometimes exhibits a very odd sense of humour. When asked why Thailand had refused offers of help from foreign bomb experts, ruling General Prayut Chan-o-cha said they were unwelcome attempts to intervene. Instead, he urged Thai police to watch the American TV crime drama Blue Bloods to get tips, ideas and insights. Observers have their own insights. Anthony Davis is from Jane's Intelligence Review.
Well, the investigation appears to be losing steam, slowing down.
It's now 9 days since the bombing, and the best lead is the motorcycle taxi driver who carried the suspect from the scene to a local park. The driver spoke to our sister program, AM.
He showed me a piece of paper to read. It says in English, Lumpini Park. I told him the price was 30 baht. He nodded but did not say anything. So I drove down the main street towards the park. After a while, he started talking on the phone. I don't know if someone called him or if he made the call. I wondered why he talked all the time on the phone. He stopped talking when we almost arrived at the park.
The majority of those killed were ethnic Chinese worshippers from across Asia who flocked to the shrine in the belief that prayers there bring good fortune. Anthony Davis from Jane's says that has narrowed possible motives.
The theories thrown around in profusion have looked at domestic Thai politics. Red shirts, pro-Thaksin people, seeking to destabilize the military government. Yellow shirts, pro-royalist, pro-establishment individuals seeking to make Thaksin look like some sort of a mass murderer. Rogue factions within the security forces. So that whole gamut is out there. There is another line of speculation. My own view is that this had nothing to do with domestic Thai politics. The sheer scale of the violence in the heart of the capital at a religious shrine and directed at foreigners, all of these factors are totally unlike any sort of violence that has been connected with the Thai political divide in the last 10 years or more.
It's Anthony Davis's view that militant Muslims from China's Uyghur minority did it as payback to avenge Thailand's forced repatriation in July of more than 100 Uyghurs who'd fled their homeland.
You have, arguably, what we saw on the night of Monday the 17th, namely a two for the price of one. What was hit was the Thai state in the heart of the capital, the foreign tourist industry, which is hugely important in this country, and also Chinese tourists, primarily. The Erawan Shrine is mainly popular among Chinese, both from the mainland and other Chinese communities in the region. So, two for the price of one.
If undermining tourism confidence was the intent of the bombers, it appears to have failed. The latest figures from Thailand's tourism ministry show inbound visitor numbers at normal levels.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Japanese group bidding for Australia's submarine contract has denied any secret deal between the Japanese and Australian prime ministers to award them the contract. A government and industry delegation from Japan addressed the Australian media for the first time this week and met the local industry. Political pressure is building on the coalition to build the submarines in Adelaide, but the Japanese delegation refused to say what its preference is and where the vessels are built. From Adelaide, Natalie Whiting reports.
More than 100 shipbuilding and defence industry members crowded into a conference room to hear from the Japanese submarine delegation.
Could I start, ladies and gentlemen, by acknowledging Admiral Takashi Saito?
While Japanese representatives have visited Adelaide in the past, this is the first high-profile public visit they've made. Admiral Takashi Saito is heading the government-led bid. He says the Soryu-class submarine is a top vessel because it's so quiet and has a long range.
I am confident that the Australian future submarine, jointly developed between Australia and Japan, based on this Soryu-class submarine, will be the top-level submarine in the world. And it's, with its proven history, we are confident that we can build the Australian future submarine with low risk.
But he wouldn't say what Japan's preference was for where the submarines should be built.
Currently, the team in Japan are seriously considering and working on all three build options: Japanese build, hybrid build, and Australian build. And at this moment, we are not yet determined which is good or which is bad. So we are still in such a stage, but again, we are seriously considering all three build options.
The German and French competitors have both publicly supported building the submarines in Australia. The Japanese acknowledged they've been lagging behind their counterparts when it comes to public relations and say that's why they've made this visit. Industry members who attended the briefing were glad they did.
They've hesitated to do it so far, but a very positive direction that they really need to engage with the Australian people and talk about the culture and the language differences and the barriers that may be in place.
Each of the three competitors, the French and the Germans, and now the Japanese, have been and talked to the local industry and encouraging the local industry to become part of the project. So whoever wins, local industry here in South Australia should be very much involved with the whole project.
A very positive sign. I think because they've come from a nation that doesn't typically export, this is all new to them, and I think this is a very positive step in the right direction to engage with the local industry here in Australia.
Yes, up until now, has there been more engagement from the French and German competitors?
To date, yes. We've had three visits from the Japanese, though, so it's not like they haven't actually been reaching out at all. But I think the French and the Germans have been working this market for the last 10 years. So they've been looking forward to future submarine for a long time. whereas the Japanese really only come into this in the last 12 months. So they're starting from behind in that respect.
There's been ongoing speculation that the Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, made a handshake deal with his Japanese counterpart, Shinzo Abe, for the submarine build. But Admiral Saito was adamant when asked about it.
Absolutely, there is no such a deal between the two governments.
But the South Australian Defence Minister, Martin Hamilton Smith, didn't sound convinced.
Well, look, I remain very concerned that some may be going into this process with a preconceived notion of its outcome. I hope that's not the case, but there have been some widely circulated reports that some sort of a secret deal has been done between Japan and the current Prime Minister. But we can only hope that this is an open, a fair and a proper process, and that what we get out of it at the end is the best decision for Australia.
He says the state government pushed the local build option during a meeting with the Japanese.
The South Australian government is agnostic on the question of which submarine is chosen. That is a decision for the Royal Australian Navy. But we are firm in our resolve that the successful submarine must be built in Australia.
You've previously criticised the Japanese for being secretive, especially when they didn't attend a recent Senate hearing here. How heartening is it to see this very public visit?
Yeah, I think it's quite heartening, and we now have had all of the three bidders visit Adelaide with a serious intent to learn more about industry and to prepare a serious and genuine bid for an Australian build, and I hope that is the outcome that we get.
All three competitors will submit their applications in November ahead of a decision being made next year.
One of the first reporters to arrive at the Tianjin port after the major explosion a couple of weeks ago was Hui Fen Tay, our Beijing correspondent. At this moment, the noxious gas clouds are continuing and there is skyrocketing cyanide levels. She now tells us what she saw when she arrived at Tianjin.
As we drove past a hospital in Tianjin, we saw many tents pitched outside with cartons of water stacked underneath. This was where the injured were being treated after twin massive explosions tore through a chemical warehouse, killing more than 100 people. Shocked residents captured the moment on camera.
Oh my God! Oh shit! Oh my God! Look at that!
Locals had come out to help in a tragedy that was the worst since the founding of modern China, and we wanted to film this display of community spirit. What happened later was bizarre. Soon after we set up our camera next to one of the tents, a police officer came up to us. Do you have a press card? He asked. Then came a group of young men in plain clothes. They identified themselves as volunteers. Go away, you are not allowed to film here, they shouted as one of them reached out for the camera. Their aggression shocked us. No one could explain why we were not allowed to stay while a Chinese television crew could. Everyone stuck to the same line. That is, the police say you can't film here, so stop asking why. We left the hospital taken aback by the animosity. As it turned out, other foreign journalists also encountered similar problems outside the hospital. The treatment we received from volunteers elsewhere in the city could not have been more different. One incident happened at a primary school used as a temporary shelter. A steady stream of people turned up with boxes of food and water for the residents displaced by the explosions. These volunteers made sure we had some too. When we urgently needed a lift somewhere, it did not take long before a man stopped to help. I also won't forget the time when a person pulled over in his car to offer me a face mask while I was preparing to do a cross for News 24. These acts of generosity touched me and my crew. We want to thank the volunteers again for their kindness. As for the group outside the hospital, I still have the same question for them and more. Why and who are you? Were they hired thugs? After all, at the ABC, we have encountered this before when covering stories about forced demolitions. or were the men simply overzealous locals? Either way, their main task was to stop the foreign media. However, their actions did not prevent the press and the public from asking sensitive questions about the tragedy. For example, why were some apartments so close to a warehouse full of toxic chemicals? Were the firefighters adequately trained? And what were they told about what was stored at the warehouse? The families who have lost loved ones and people whose homes are now unlivable are just some of those waiting for answers.
That was Wei Fen Tay reporting from Beijing on what happened when she showed up at the port in Tianjin where the massive explosion took place. In East Jakarta, there have been violent street protests as police forcefully evict thousands of residents. In a city where the infrastructure is struggling to keep pace with the rapid expanding economy, the government says the slum-like housing estate needs to be demolished because of yearly flooding. But the locals think otherwise. Our Indonesia correspondent, Samantha Holy, reports from Jakarta.
Hundreds of riot police stand with shields raised. Bulldozers are ready to move in, but the residents don't want to leave. Rocks, bricks, anything they can find is hurled at the police line. Down a nearby alley, the residents who've already lost the battle to keep their mainly makeshift homes sit aimlessly. For them, it's their livelihoods lost. 48-year-old Rukmini's home has already been crushed. She lived in it for 48 years and struggles to comprehend a move that's been forced on her. "I'm so sad," she says. "I saw my house get knocked down earlier. I screamed. My heart is broken." Jakarta's governor, who's known as a hawk, took over the reins from the current president, Joko Widodo. Known for his bluntness, he's on a mission to clean up the city, and he has his work cut out for him in the infrastructure poor, car-heavy, flood-prone capital. Omar Farouk is the East Jakarta police chief in charge of the non-negotiable evictions. He points out the high-rise building where the residents are being moved to. It's no more than a kilometre away. "These are run-down houses here," he says. "They get flooded all the time. There's usually about a 2-metre wall of water. But wander down the small alleys and you'll meet faces of despair." "We don't mind the flooding," this man tells me. "We're used to it. And after the flood, we clean up and it's normal again." The high-rise accommodation is new and clean. The two-bedroom flats have a functioning kitchen and bathroom. It's relative luxury. But here in Jakarta's east, these residents are fighting for the place they call home. This is Samantha Hawley in Jakarta reporting.
The brother of a 23-year-old asylum seeker who has been moved from Nauru to Australia for urgent medical treatment says he's grateful his sister is now in a Brisbane hospital. The Iranian woman was allegedly raped in May. Since then, she's been on a hunger strike and has attempted suicide at least twice. The Refugee Action Coalition says the woman's case is not an isolated one, and it claims there are a number of female asylum seekers on Nauru who've been sexually assaulted. Linda Karen has the story.
The 23-year-old woman was out visiting a friend on the island back in May. It was on her return to the detention centre that she was brutally attacked. Her brother, who we won't name, says she was severely traumatised by the sexual assault and stopped eating and drinking. He says earlier this week her kidneys began to fail. He's told The World Today he's relieved his sister has been moved to Australia for treatment.
"It's better because of we can see that now she'll have proper treatment and proper medical care in really better situation, and that was really important for us."
"Did you get to see your sister before she was moved from Nauru?"
Yes, I just see her and said goodbye to her."
The woman's brother says the Nauruan police investigation into the case appears to be moving slowly.
"I think that they didn't have any progress, even in identifying that person. They didn't have any progress or practically, we haven't seen any progress, and that's the truth.
An anonymous submission provided to the Senate inquiry into Nauru says the woman was found distraught and running down the street half naked with bruising and bite marks. It claims she was held in the back of a police car for 45 minutes while officers watched a fireworks display. In a statement, the government of Nauru has rejected that claim, saying it
will not and should not be expected to respond to scurrilous and anonymous accusations against its police force. These claims are completely wrong and are rejected outright. This investigation is ongoing. However, unfortunately, the victim has not been cooperating with police, making the investigation more difficult.
Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young says the 23-year-old woman should have been moved to Nauru months ago. She told AM this morning the woman's case is not an isolated one and that another six women have been moved from Nauru after being attacked.
About half a dozen women that I've met with here in Australian Rainland that have been, after lobbying, after advocating, after they've gotten in a very, very bad way, they've been finally transferred to Australia. One young woman told me, as she was so broken, tears streaming down her face when I met her inside the Melbourne Detention Centre only 3 weeks ago, that she was in her tent in Nauru in the camp. She'd been prescribed sleeping tablets from the medical staff, and she woke up with a guard on top of her and effectively raping her inside her tent. And this is these are the types of experiences that these women have described to me.
Ian Rintoul from the Refugee Action Coalition says he's planning to visit the 23-year-old woman in Brisbane over the weekend. He agrees she should have been moved earlier.
So I'll try to follow up, you know, personally as soon as I can get to Brisbane. We'll be getting other people to visit. If that's going to take a day or two, we'll certainly be getting other people to visit her as soon as possible so that she knows that there are, you know, supporters.
Ian Rintoul says he's aware of three other women who've been raped on Nauru and moved to Australia for treatment.
Just the tip of the iceberg. There is absolutely no doubt about that. The Nauruan police have reports. There are identifications that have been made of perpetrators that simply have not been followed up at all. There are already, you know, three others who have been brought, who have been victims of rape, have been brought from Nauru to Australia. I think it is beholden upon the immigration authorities to bring all the victims, you know, of sexual assault and rape from, you know, Nauru to Australia.
And with that report from Linda Caron, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pennell, wishing you all we'll see you again very soon. Until next time, so long and take care.